This episode features discussion of terrorism and animal cruelty that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
In the spring of 1981, horse racing enthusiasts sat around the track at the Sandown Classic Trial, one of the first derbies of the season. Few paid attention to the scrawny, knobby-kneed colt preparing to run his first race.
But that quickly changed. As the jockeys urged their horses forward, the tiny colt began to edge its way ahead of the competition. Onlookers checked their programs and saw his name was Shergar.
The small horse easily cantered to the front of the ranks, his tongue lolling out of his mouth. Men who had bet against him grew furious. Trainers watched in awe as the colt, just 3 years old, sailed across the finish line by 10 lengths, a blowout by Derby standards.
Afterwards, word of Shergar's potential spread fast. One newspaper wrote, "Shergar for the Derby. Now is the time to bet like men."
His next race was an annihilation, winning by 12 lengths.
Shergar went on to win the famous Epsom Derby by 10 lengths, the longest win margin in the race's 226-year history. The horse was a phenomenon, and his value climbed into the millions overnight.
His owner was elated. In a matter of weeks, Shergar had become the most valuable racing horse in the world. Everyone in the country knew his name, but not everyone wished him well. This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast, telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and the way high-pressure scenarios can affect negotiations.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast's podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our first episode on the abduction of Shergar, the prized Irish racehorse whose kidnapping sent the entire country of Ireland into a frenzy.
This week, we'll look at what endeared Shergar to the Irish people and what made him such a valuable hostage. While this case is still technically unsolved, we'll also delve into the IRA, the terrorist organization that many believe stole him from his stable in the middle of the night.
Next week, as the kidnapping of Shergar becomes an international affair, we'll follow the negotiation attempts to recover the prized horse and learn the motives of Shergar's deadly captors.
In 1981, Shergar was the most valuable racehorse in the world, and his disappearance sent shockwaves around Ireland. He was beloved by the Irish people, who adored him as much as any famous athlete. He was an unlikely champion, whose quick rise to prominence made him a household name.
After his capture, rumors spread like wildfire. The public thought he could have been taken by the Irish mob, by horse breeders looking to capitalize on his prized reputation as a stud. Even the dictator of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, was a popular suspect. But in truth, Shergar was a mere pawn in a political chess match, abducted by an extremist group pushing Ireland towards the brink of civil war.
The 1970s and 80s were a tumultuous time in Ireland, especially in Northern Ireland around Belfast. A terrorist organization known as the Irish Republican Army, or IRA, had come to prominence and was in the thick of a 30-year string of attacks against its own people.
From 1968 to 1998, Northern Irish people lived in constant fear of the IRA, who amassed over 1,800 casualties during that time, many of which were civilian lives.
In the simplest terms, the IRA believed that Northern Ireland was suffocated by British rule and overrun by Protestant Christians. They worked to reunite Northern Ireland with the largely Catholic Republic of Ireland to the south.
The IRA were guilty of a myriad of war crimes throughout the 20th century. In the 70s, they began murdering civilians at random in areas where the general population opposed them. They didn't distinguish between Protestants and Catholics. They wanted to inspire fear to squelch dissent.
During that time, they also began exacting revenge on men who spoke out against them by murdering their target's wife and children while leaving their mark alive.
The IRA also became notorious for their use of car bombs, used to kill political operatives and civilians and to cause widespread panic. Families would go to work in the morning to discover their small business had been bombed in the night. Churches were frequent targets, as were busy street corners.
It was a terrifying time to live in Northern Ireland, and the ramifications of the IRA's terror are still felt in Belfast today.
But while Northern Ireland lived in a constant state of oppression and fear, the Republic of Ireland to the south was a thriving, internationally minded country. And since the Republic inception in 1922, horse racing had been a wildly popular sport.
The thoroughbred horse, Shergar, was, by all accounts, an underdog. He didn't look like a noble racehorse with his odd frame, white face, and socks. And the way his tongue lolled out of his mouth when he ran. Bred in County Kildare in Ireland, Shergar trained as a racehorse under the renowned tutelage of Sir Michael Stout, who would later become the first trainer to have a 1-2-3 finish at the prestigious Ascot King George VI and Queen Elizabeth Stakes Derby in 2009.
Shergar's debut race was in 1981 at the Guardian Classic Trial at Sandown Park. He stunned the equestrian world when he won the race by 10 lengths, meaning 10 horses could have fit in the space between him and his trailing competitor. By normal race standards, this was a blowout.
Some chalk this up to beginner's luck, but he quickly went on to win the Chester Vaz Derby by 12 lengths, creaming the crowd favorite, a thoroughbred named Glint of Gold. Shergar's unceremonious style and haphazard name originally made him a joke, but after this second formidable win, Shergar started to turn heads.
He competed in 3 more races, winning 2 of them, but it wasn't until his race at the Epsom Derby on June 2, 1981, that he truly made a name for himself. Possibly because the race had been so close until moments before the finish line. It was his 6th race, the final race of his season.
The horses burst from their gates and ran in a tight pack for the majority of the race. Shergar stuck in the middle.
The horses around him began to break out of the pack and push forward, hugging the fence, making it impossible for Shergar to break through.
It wasn't until the very last lap that Shergar saw a window and weaved ahead, now neck in neck with the lead horse.
And as they came onto the straightaway for their final lap, Shergar edged ahead. Then, to everyone's shock, he started to gain speed.
He not only pulled ahead, he gained a huge lead. The crowd went crazy as the distance between Shergar and the pack widened.
He crossed the finish line to thunderous cheers. He had won the race by 10 lengths, the longest winning margin in Epsom history. Not only had Shergar cemented his status as a top racehorse, he quickly became lucrative for his owner, an equally impressive socialite.
Born in 1936 in Geneva, Shergar's owner, Karim Aga Khan IV, is known for many things. He grew up in Nairobi, Kenya, studied in Switzerland, and graduated from Harvard. He's a multimillionaire and social elite with a vast estate near Chantilly, France. He is twice divorced, having lost a combined total of around $70 million in the settlements. That's about $400 million in today's money, which didn't seem to make a dent in his coffers. He's still an avid philanthropist, funding charity projects throughout the developing world.
Perhaps most impressive, in 1957, at only 20 years old, Karim Aga Khan succeeded his grandfather as the 49th Imam, or spiritual leader for the world's 15 million Shia Ismaili Muslims.
His family has passed down the title of Imam for 1,300 years. Many believed the Aga Khan, as he is called, can trace his lineage back to the Prophet Muhammad. When the Aga Khan, a British citizen, assumed the role of Imam, Queen Elizabeth II also bestowed upon him the title His Highness. This made his full name His Highness Prince Karim Aga Khan IV.
Yet for all these accomplishments, his legacy will forever be tied to the most notorious kidnapping in the equine world, the abduction of Shergar, his most prized horse.
After winning Epsom, Shergar was syndicated for breeding. This essentially means that instead of racing, Shergar was going to be used to breed foals, who would hopefully inherit his racing prowess. When this happens, horse owners will usually sell stock in their horse, and Shergar was no exception.
The Aga Khan retained a few shares in Shergar and sold 40 shares to 34 other businessmen around the world. Each share cost 250,000 GBP. Shergar was essentially a for-profit public company. From the day his shares were sold, he was valued at 10 million GBP, a record for stallions in Europe at the time. Today, that would be around 38 million US dollars. But he soon proved a worthwhile investment. Shergar's stud fee was 80,000 GBP. This meant that anyone who wanted Shergar to father a foal would pay 80,000 GBP for a single stud session.
Shergar went on to produce 35 foals in a single stud season in 1982, proving lucrative for his investors. After just 1 year, his worth doubled to 20 million GBP.
And while this spelled out great news for those with financial stake in Shergar, it also attracted the attention of others looking to make a quick buck.
After only one victorious season on the track and a handful of races, Shergar had retired to the horse farm outside Dublin called Ballymenny Stud.
On February 8, 1983, Ballymenny's head groom, 53-year-old Jim Fitzgerald, relaxed at home with his family. Fitzgerald had raised Shergar since he was a foal. Just after 8:30 p.m., Fitzgerald heard a knock on his door. He sent his son, Bernard, to answer it.
The Fitzgeralds rarely had late-night visitors, but he never expected what was on the other side of the door.
Three masked gunmen charged into Jim's home and pointed their guns at Jim's family, challenging any of them to move. One assailant shoved a gun in Jim's face and snarled, "We've come for Shergar. We want £2 million ransom for him."
The masked assailant shoved Jim out the door and walked him to the stables, where Jim had no choice but to unlock Shergar's stable and load him onto a stolen horse trailer.
It was at this point that Jim realized how vastly outnumbered his family was. At the stable, eight additional gunmen were waiting for him, just in case he tried any funny business.
The gunman who had led Jim from his home now shoved Jim towards a car. Jim, too afraid to speak, didn't ask where he was being taken.
One man, seemingly the leader of the group, called to two of his comrades and told them to stay behind and guard Fitzgerald's family to make sure they didn't call the police or try to run for help.
Jim's heart was pounding out of his chest. It was bad enough that he was being taken, that Shergar was being stolen, but to leave two of these madmen with his family felt unthinkable.
But if Jim had any complaints, he didn't have a moment to voice them. As Shergar was shoved into a trailer tied to a truck, Jim was pushed onto the floor of a van with three other members of the bandwagon, and the van peeled away from Ballymenny Stud. He didn't know whether the truck towing Shergar was following them or headed towards a different location.
It was the most terrifying moment of Jim's life. He had no idea who was taking him or whether they would kill him. One man kept a revolver jammed into his face and grew more aggressive as the abduction progressed.
Jim was sure they were going to kill him. Entering this hostage situation, Jim was put at an immense disadvantage for survival. According to former FBI hostage negotiator Thomas Strentz, there are 9 different types of hostage takers, and each of them must be dealt with in a different way. What could save a hostage in some situations might only serve to anger another type of captor. Had Jim known which personality types had taken him hostage, he would have put himself at the highest possible chance for survival. Of course, he also would have had to know exactly how to negotiate with said personality type for it to be of any use.
But Jim did, however, instinctively sense that these men were not insane or unreasonable, and he knew that they were doing this for monetary gain. He decided that his best course of action was following directions and staying calm, which was exactly right, according to Strentz.
The car pulled down a back road. It was pitch black in every direction. Jim knew the fields they were driving through. They were only a few miles from his home.
Eventually, the car pulled over onto the side of the road, and Jim was forced out of the car. He worried that they might shoot him in the head, execution style, and leave him for dead on the side of the road.
Instead, one of the gunmen told him to walk across the field in front of him and not turn around unless he wanted to eat a bullet. He warned that Jim shouldn't call the police. The kidnappers promised to be in touch, using the code name King Neptune and the code word Kildare 4150. Fitzgerald assured them he understood, and he marched slowly across the field, never daring to turn around, even though he had heard their car squeal away.
Jim marched across the field towards lights in the distance, a small village where he could call for help. His mind raced with worry over his family, who had been left alone with 2 gunmen, and to thoughts of Shergar, the most valuable racing horse in the world, who at this point could be absolutely anywhere.
We'll jump into the hunt for Shergar after this. Now back to the story.
On February 8th, 1983, after spending hours in the back of a car at gunpoint, Jim Fitzgerald had been abandoned in a field and left to walk home. He walked to the nearest village, never daring to look over his shoulder and see if his kidnappers were still watching him. He made it to the local pub and called his brother to give him a ride home.
Meanwhile, the kidnappers were making moves of their own. Around the same time, 4 hours after prize racehorse Shergar had been kidnapped, a horse breeder near Belfast received an unusual call.
His name was Jeremy Maxwell, and he lived about 140 miles north of where Shergar had been taken. Maxwell's phone rang around midnight. It was the kidnappers. Maxwell has since described the voice on the other end as an educated Southern Irish accent. It had to be King Neptune.
The man on the other line explained that they had kidnapped Shergar and wanted £40,000 in exchange for him. Maxwell was unaware that Shergar's captors had originally told Jim the ransom was £2 million, a key clue that would go unreported for hours. Nevertheless, Neptune assured Maxwell that the horse was in good condition, and if he wanted proof that they had Shergar, the man said he would be happy to send the horse's ear.
Maxwell was utterly confused. First of all, he had no connection to Shergar and couldn't understand why he'd been called. Second, there had been nothing about Shergar's kidnapping on the news, so he assumed this was a prank call. He hung up. But 30 minutes later, the man called back.
At this point, Maxwell began to suspect that this wasn't a prank. He asked the horse snapper to take good care of Shergar, then hung up once again. He still assumed the calls to be hoaxes and didn't call the police, although he slept a little more restlessly that night.
Meanwhile, back in County Kildare, Jim Fitzgerald was returning home.
There, he was relieved to see that his family hadn't been harmed, that all six of his children were safe and accounted for.
But now came the arduous task of raising the alarm. Shergar was the most beloved horse in Ireland. News of his disappearance would be hard to swallow.
A little after midnight on February 9th, 1983, Jim Fitzgerald phoned the stud manager, Gislin Drian, who in turn called Shergar's vet and shareholder, Stan Cosgrove. Cosgrove was a warm-hearted and well-respected vet in the racing community, with a deep voice and heavy accent, even by Irish standards. He was the kind of person you call in times of trouble, as he always knew what to do.
But in this one rare instance, even Cosgrove was at a loss. All three men were scared to call the police. They still had no idea who had kidnapped Shergar, or what they might do if they sensed police involvement. Remember, it wasn't just a horse on the line. It was 20 million pounds.
At almost the exact same time, midnight on February 9th, 1983, the BBC Belfast was also dealing with an unusual debacle. King Neptune had called them and explained that Shergar had been abducted, and he was only willing to negotiate with three men for the horse's release: Derek Thompson and John Oaksey with ITV Sport, and Peter Campling of The Sun. These three men were horse racing journalists and experts in their field.
The BBC shared Jeremy Maxwell's confusion, but they were in a better position to take action and immediately began to reach out to the three men named to see if they knew anything about the disappearance. Derek Thompson was to take the lead on the negotiations. He was a celebrity within Ireland, having become the youngest horse race commentator on radio at 22 years old. It seemed only fitting that he bring Shergar home.
At the same time, in the Republic of Ireland, Shergar's groomer, vet, and stud manager were at a standstill, afraid to call police and afraid to stand idly by. Then Cosgrove had an idea. He called a friend, former Army officer Captain Sean Barry. Barry understood the need for discretion, at least in the immediate, and called the Minister to Parliament and Irish Minister for Finance, Alan Dukes, presumably because a ransom was involved. Dukes was horrified to learn of the horse's kidnapping and rang the Justice Minister.
This elaborate game of telephone lasted until 4 a.m., approximately 8 hours after the abduction, when the Irish police, or Garda, were finally alerted. The Garda were distraught, realizing that 8 hours had been wasted in Shergar's kidnapping. In that time, the horse could have been smuggled anywhere in Ireland or taken out of the country completely. They sprang into action.
According to the journalist Hannah Moore with the BBC, the first 72 hours are the most critical when finding a missing person, or in this case, a missing horse. After this amount of time, leads tend to go cold and cases are almost never solved, save an incredibly lucky break.
More chilling, according to FBI statistics, 99% of those abducted and murdered are killed within the first 24 hours of their capture. That's not to say that 99% of hostages are murdered, but if the captors plan to murder them, they're on borrowed time from the moment they are taken.
At the time, nobody knew who had captured Shergar or why, so the police immediately assumed that harm could very likely come to the horse. Police Superintendent James Murphy expanded on that fear, saying that the people who took Shergar might not have known how to care for a horse and could have injured Shergar inadvertently as well as intentionally.
As the police became aware of the abduction around 4 a.m. on February 9, 1983, they were also contacted by the BBC Belfast, who relayed what they had been told by King Neptune. after quickly conferring with police, BBC Belfast broke the story on the national news.
The police were equally confused about conflicting information in the ransom requests. Jim Fitzgerald had been told £2 million, but the Maxwells had only been asked for £40,000. It was a huge discrepancy that made no sense. But Superintendent Murphy had been a cop long enough to know that the higher ransom amount was usually the correct one. And luckily for Murphy, and unbeknownst to the captors, the figure rang suspicious.
The Garda, or Irish police, also noted the specific date of Shergar's kidnapping. Shergar had been abducted the day before Ireland's major racehorse sale, an annual event in which horse trailers would be driven the length of the country in large numbers, making it much more difficult to spot the trailer carrying Shergar. These thieves were smart, but not infallible.
The news about Shergar's disappearance publicly broke around noon the following day. While police were busy attempting to track down the horse, the general public went into a frenzy over the missing Shergar. It might seem utterly naive, but at the time, horse theft was fairly unprecedented in Ireland, especially with a national treasure like Shergar. It seemed unthinkable that this could happen. The country was called to action to help return Shergar to the care of his groom Jim Fitzgerald and the Aga Khan.
Garda Superintendent James Murphy was put in charge of Shergar's case, and he knew from the onset that it would be the biggest case of his career. He was stationed in the small town of Newbridge in County Kildare, where Ballymenny Stud was located. Journalists from around the world began to descend on the tiny village to cover Shergar's disappearance.
70 detectives and police personnel were initially put on the case and ordered to search every farm and stable in Ireland, which they did with a fervor. But as feared, there was no sign of the horse.
Meanwhile, King Neptune continued to demand that the three equine journalists he'd requested be sent to Belfast to begin negotiations.
Thompson later said that Shergar was the most important racehorse in the world, and it felt like being asked to negotiate for the release of a famous football player or sports icon. He was happy to help in any way possible.
Thompson, Oaksey, and Campling flew to Belfast on the afternoon of February 9th, 1983, less than a day after Shergar had been taken. They were sent to the Europa Hotel in central Belfast. Europa Hotel was a telling pick. The hotel was infamous for being the most bombed hotel in Europe. It survived multiple bombing attacks during the Northern Ireland conflict, more commonly referred to as the conflict. Most of those bombings had taken place in the last 10 years.
And while police had still not identified King Neptune or verified what ransom amount he would be demanding, it was the location in Belfast and the mention of £2 million that gave police an idea of who they might be dealing with. The IRA became infamous during the Troubles of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but they've actually been fighting British rule in Ireland since 1919.
Their guerrilla tactics led to a negotiation with the British government in 1921, creating the Irish Free State, now known as the Republic of Ireland, while Northern Ireland remained part of the United Kingdom.
But these terms were unacceptable to some members of the IRA, who broke off and became a faction known as the Irregulars. They ignited a civil war within Ireland from 1922 to 1923, after which time they were subdued but never disbanded.
By the 1970s, the IRA was importing weapons to wage war on their own countrymen. By the early 1980s, it was estimated that the operating cost of the IRA was around £2 million per year. £2 million. The same amount as Shergar's possible ransom.
And while it was little more than a hunch, Superintendent Murphy tucked that parallel into the back of his mind as his agents combed the country.
But Murphy knew that there was a long list of people who could potentially benefit from abducting Shergar. Other breeders, competing horse owners. He was slow to rule out any options, especially if King Neptune got back on the phone and asked for a mere 40,000 pounds, which would suggest a far smaller operation.
Murphy was smart enough to withhold his suspicions from the public, preferring to keep his cards close to the vest. Besides, he had no proof and didn't want to involve an active, dangerous terrorist organization before he was positive they were at fault.
However, this discovery did help Murphy narrow down the type of hostage taker he was dealing with. To Murphy, it seemed safe to rule out any and all personality types that would be categorized as emotionally disturbed or motivated.
If King Neptune was part of the IRA, it meant that Murphy was dealing with an extremist, someone who was motivated for political and non-personal reasons. This meant that the hostage taker was less likely to be mentally or emotionally unstable, which was good. It also meant that he was likely to be more unyielding and relentless in his quest for ransom. According to FBI negotiator Thomas Strentz, King Neptune was probably also very concerned with Shergar's kidnapping receiving media attention to bring publicity to the IRA's cause. Murphy bore all of this in mind as he went along with King Neptune's requests.
King Neptune must have been pleased to see that the three journalists had arrived at Europa Hotel.
Up to this point, the entire hostage negotiation had been fully within King Neptune's control, so he carried on with the rest of his demands.
That afternoon, Gislin Drion, the grooming manager at Shergar Stable, received a phone call. The voice on the other end was low, a Northern Irish accent.
The man said, "Is this Kildare 4150? Mr. Drion, this is King Neptune."
Drion froze. He had heard these code words from Jim Fitzgerald. He knew that the man who had taken Shergar was on the other line. He also knew that at this moment, three journalists were on their way to Belfast to negotiate for Shergar's freedom.
King Neptune continued, "I'm not going to repeat anything. You're going to listen." He went on to demand £2 million ransom for Shergar and demanded a French phone number to use for contact.
This was a fairly ingenious move. Due to technological limitations at the time, it was nearly impossible to trace international numbers. By calling from a landline in Ireland to a landline in Paris, the chances were incredibly slim that anyone would be able to trace the call and find King Neptune's location. It was the kind of demand that only an experienced criminal would know to make.
Drion assured him that it would be seen to and hung up. Immediately, he called Chief Superintendent Murphy to give him the list of demands. Murphy set to work, setting up a Paris office to field King Neptune's calls. Drion didn't know it, but Murphy had a secret, and it might have been enough to save Shergar's life.
The mystery of Shergar's whereabouts thickens in just a moment.
Now, back to the story.
On February 9th, 1983, Derek Thompson and his journalist cohorts had arrived at Europa Hotel in Belfast, ready to negotiate for the release of kidnapped racehorse Shergar.
Within 30 seconds of arriving at the hotel, Thompson was approached by hotel staff and told he had a phone call at the front desk. Thompson recognized the caller's crisp Southern Irish voice in an instant. It was the man police were calling King Neptune.
Thompson felt uneasy knowing that King Neptune knew the exact moment he had stepped foot into the hotel. He must have had eyes on the building keeping close watch. Although this did remind Thompson and his fellow journalist to toe the line or else.
King Neptune asked Thompson if he knew the Maxwells, the breeders who had been called around midnight, 4 hours after Shergar was taken. They lived in a farm about 30 minutes north of Belfast, and Thompson was instructed to pay them a visit.
The men made the journey north and arrived at the Maxwell's farm in the late evening. The farm was surrounded by RUC, or Royal Ulster Constables, the Northern Ireland police force.
The air was thick inside the Maxwell's home, and everyone sat on the edge of their seat awaiting a phone call.
As the hours ticked by, the room grew increasingly tense. Was this an ambush? A hoax? Thompson considered the possibilities.
The most frustrating part of these negotiations were that the police had very little control. They had no idea who specifically had taken Shergar, no idea where the horse was, and were not being communicated with directly. In hostage negotiations, direct contact with the hostage takers always provides the greatest margin for success, according to Strentz.
By negotiating through a proxy, King Neptune was all but guaranteeing he would retain the upper hand.
The only game plan going into these negotiations was to keep King Neptune talking, to make him feel heard, and to get a complete list of his demands. Thompson had not been given a dollar amount directly, although the Maxwells told him that the night before, the man had said 40,000 pounds. According to Strentz, an effective hostage negotiator should only speak about 20% of the time, with the hostage taker dominating the conversation. Especially in cases of political extremism, it's very important for the hostage taker to feel heard.
And while this method of negotiation was not ideal, it did carry a hidden benefit. By communicating through proxy, Thompson and his cohorts were put in the position of good cop.
Essentially, no matter what demands King Neptune made, Thompson would not be telling him no outright. He would need to get everything approved through the police and Shergar's shareholders. According to Thomas Strentz, this instinctively left a little window of hope open at the end of his conversations with King Neptune, keeping him in King Neptune's good graces. It was an ideal good cop, bad cop scenario that police hoped would play out in their favor.
Finally, around 1:15 in the morning, a little over 24 hours after Shergar had been taken, the phone rang. The Southern Irish voice greeted Derek Thompson and told him that Thompson could call him Arco. It seemed weird to Thompson that the man police were calling King Neptune would introduce himself as Arco, but he pressed on.
Thompson knew that police had been hoping to trace the call when it eventually came in, so he kept Arco on the phone for as long as possible. Thompson kept repeating the same questions, asking if Shergar was okay, verifying the ransom amount, killing time to keep Arco on the phone. After about 3 minutes, Arco hung up the phone. Thompson whipped around to the officer on duty and said, "Surely you must have traced the call." But the officer went beet red and admitted that the man who usually traces calls for the department had gone off duty at midnight, so the call hadn't been traced.
Thompson hung his head in defeat, knowing that their window for Shergar's safe return was closing. They were now 29 hours into their 72-hour window. With the 24 most crucial hours behind them, things were not looking good.
The next morning, Arco called again. This time, there was a slowness to his voice that made Thompson uneasy. He told Thompson that he was very sorry, but there'd been an accident, and Shergar was dead. He hung up, the line went dead, never to call the Maxwells again.
Derek Thompson couldn't believe what he had just heard. After all the panic, the hysteria, the dramatic capture, the rigmarole with police, for it to end so unceremoniously seemed so unfair. He also wasn't sure that the information was true. It could have been some kind of ploy, although he didn't know what.
Thompson phoned Superintendent Murphy to relay the message of Shergar's possible passing. Murphy understandably took this news pretty hard. Thompson gave Murphy what information he could, the time the calls took place, what was said, and King Neptune's new code name, Arco.
Murphy thanked him and hung up. dreading a pending press conference scheduled for later that morning. He would have to tell the world that Ireland's most beloved horse was dead.
Then Murphy received another call. It was Drian, the groomer at Shergar's stud farm. Drian had news. What he was about to tell Superintendent Murphy was going to turn the entire investigation on its head. Drian told Murphy that he'd just received a call from a man who introduced himself as King Neptune and had given him the code word Kildare 4150. This King Neptune said Jim Fitzgerald would know the code. And indeed, it was the code word given to Jim as he was shoved from the van on February 9th. Drian then described King Neptune's voice, a far cry from Arco's refined Southern Irish accent.
Murphy didn't understand. He asked Drian to repeat himself. It just didn't make sense. How could this be possible? Could there be two King Neptunes? Then slowly he realized Arco had never given any code words. In fact, Arco had never called himself King Neptune. Murphy had just made the presumption. After all, Arco had called the Maxwells before the news of Shergar's disappearance went public. How could Arco have known about Shergar unless he had stolen him? Murphy didn't know what to think. Could they have been negotiating with a fraud? With the wrong King Neptune? And could that mean that Shergar was still alive?
Murphy's head spun with the possibility, but he was late for his press conference. He set off, mulling over the possibilities. He made a clever call and kept his cards close to the vest.
Murphy told the press that he had no leads at that point, but would continue to track down the assailants until they were brought to justice. It was general, unassuming, and an absolute lie.
Murphy was fairly convinced that the three sports journalists were puttering around Belfast on a wild goose chase, while the real kidnappers were free to set up their next move. The question now was, were Arco and King Neptune working together? Was Arco a distraction or a red herring?
One thing told Murphy that he was on the right track. The £2 million ransom demand. It matched the figure initially given to Jim Fitzgerald on the night of February 8th. It also happened to match the annual operating cost of the Irish Republican Army, whose terrorist activities had been ramping up over the past decade.
And King Neptune was the one who had asked for a French phone number. This was a smart move. By negotiating through Paris, King Neptune was afforded a cloak of invisibility through which to negotiate. But it made it harder to confirm a connection between Neptune and Arco.
Murphy knew one thing. He needed to get counterparts in Paris and a French phone number to King Neptune. He needed to stall for time and keep King Neptune talking. Even if Shergar was dead, Murphy was determined to bring these assailants to justice. He was going to unmask the real King Neptune, and he knew exactly where to start looking.
Next week, we'll follow Chief Superintendent Murphy as he connects motives and suspects in the horse abduction of the century.
There was one burning question left unanswered, one that would crack this entire case wide open. What had changed in the IRA? Why begin kidnapping tactics now?
Murphy would learn all too soon. The IRA was in need of funding, and luckily for them, an old devil had just rolled back into town. You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Aaron Land and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.